we'll get started with the talk now. So James Plested is going to be presenting the talk on Žižek. James is a long-term member of Socialist Alternative from here in Melbourne, and is a regular contributor to Red Flag, the organisation's newspaper, with a specific focus on the environment and climate change. So James is going to talk for about 40 minutes, then we'll have plenty of time afterwards for discussion.
All right. Apologies in advance. I'm pretty knackered. So I got up at 7 a.m. this morning. Actually, I was already at the conference at 7 a.m. this morning, stacking chairs, 150 chairs, probably the ones you're sitting on now. So if I'm not quite as energetic as Žižek in his speaking style, that's one of the reasons. Also, probably I didn't have any of the substances that he's been known to have. So anyway, I thought, how do you define Žižek? I thought it was impossible, but I think maybe someone on the Slavoj Žižek dank meme and discussion stash on Facebook might have managed it. They said, Žižek is a raccoon who lived in a dumpster behind the university's library who was transformed into a human by a witch. So I think that pretty much sums it up. So, all right. Anyway, so like him or not, Žižek is among the English-speaking world's most prominent left intellectuals. The extent of his fame, I think, is indicated by the fact that back in 2011, a rumour was spread that he was dating Lady Gaga, and it was actually picked up by the mainstream media. Apparently it was a bad romance, though, so... that's the last dad joke, I promise. So he's probably the closest thing we've got to a left-wing pop star. In recent years, though, his star, I think, has been fading. He's sort of yesterday's Lacanian, Hegelian, Marxist cultural critic. His peak of his fame, I think, was in the 2000s, and he's lately been dismissed by many as little more than a narcissistic crank. I do think, though, that Žižek would probably have no problem with that description. He's even guest editing an upcoming volume of the International Journal of Žižek Studies devoted to the topic of what went wrong with Žižek. So going in for a bit of self-criticism there. Okay, I think there certainly are some things that have gone wrong with Žižek. I'll mention a couple. First of all, his stance on refugees. At the height of the so-called refugee crisis in Europe in 2015, he wrote a series of articles where he sort of came across as like barely distinguishable from some of the right-wing populace. According to Žižek, for instance, it's a fact that most of the refugees come from a culture that's incompatible with Western notions of human rights. And the culture he's talking about specifically is Islam. He called for an end to the, quote, pathological fear of many Western liberal leftists who worry about being deemed guilty of Islamophobia, and claimed that the more you tolerate Islamic fundamentalism, the stronger its pressure on you will be. He wrote also that, I absolutely reject to draw the conclusion that the Western left should make here a strategic compromise and silently tolerate customs of humiliating women and gays on behalf of the greater anti-imperialist struggle. Now, strangely, there's no mention here of like the rise in homophobic attacks in Eastern Europe, for example, or the fact that it's certainly not totally alien to Western values, you know, the culture of humiliating women and sexism as well. Another thing to add is his stance, I think, on Me Too, which has obviously been quite prominent recently, the Me Too movement. One of the more insane claims he makes, which sort of came up in connection with that, was that, in his words, fundamentalists, so Islamic fundamentalists, regulate female self-presentation to forestall sexual provocation. PC feminist liberals impose a no less severe regulation of behaviour aimed at containing forms of harassment. Now, it's hard to know where to start with this. It'd be one thing if he was comparing, like, the dress codes, you know, for Muslim women to the arguably no less oppressive strictures on women in Western society to kind of make them, you know, to be kind of hypersexualized and available for the male gaze. But what he is actually suggesting, I think, is that the demand that men in Western society stop sexually harassing women is basically oppressive in the same way as demands about how women do or don't dress. And so I think that's sort of like something you'd expect from like kind of alt-right men's rights activists kind of people. Okay, So there's probably some people here who would want to dismiss him outright based on just that stuff, and there's more where that came from, but I don't really want any walkouts like straight off the bat, so perhaps that's where we'll get to in the end of the talk, but you got to hear me out. There's a whole process we've got to go through together, and then you can all walk out at the end. Okay, so for a start, I think if you're going to judge Žižek purely based on particular political positions he's taken, you have to weigh this stuff against the many examples of what I think are pretty spot-on descriptions of the kind of contradictions and absurdities of modern capitalism that you can find in his work. Particularly, he's good at skewering the small-L liberal viewpoint. The basic liberal standpoint, as he sees it, is to adopt like a moral position that presents itself as progressive, but in reality functions to reinforce the status quo of a brutally exploitative neoliberal capitalism. So, for example, against the idea of multicultural tolerance, in which the white majority Western subject deems to tolerate other cultures around them, he calls for a politics of solidarity and struggle. So as Žižek puts it, in spite of our differences, we can identify the basic antagonism or antagonistic struggle in which we're both caught. So let us share our intolerance and join forces in the same struggle. And his similarly scathing of the liberal stance against violence. He writes that to people who are just like, no, I'm opposed to all forms of violence. He says, to chastise violence outright, to condemn it as bad, is an ideological operation par excellence, a mystification which collaborates in rendering invisible the fundamental social forms of violence. Against tepid moralising liberalism and reformist politics more generally, he pits what appears to be an extreme revolutionary intransigence. The revolutionary subject, says Žižek, no longer operates at the level of demanding something from those in power. She wants to destroy them. Now, I think it's because of this kind of stuff that Žižek's work kind of resonates quite strongly with a lot of people, young people particularly, who are kind of awakening to a hatred of capitalism. And finally, I just couldn't do this talk without briefly mentioning his work on cinema, which is not going to be a focus of the talk. But if you go away from here thinking there's nothing, you know, worth your time in Žižek, you should at least read his Leninist reading of the movie La La Land, which is... No, it's quite a piece of work. So in sum, there's actually quite a lot to like in Žižek. Okay. So, however, I think we can no more purely judge him on the particular points that we agree with than on the particular points that we disagree with. And we've actually, to find out if there actually is something that we can learn in from Žižek, we've got to go beyond that and get to the theoretical framework that underlies them. All right. So first, a bit of background. So up till the late 1980s, Žižek was a relatively obscure dissident intellectual who lived in Ljubljana, I hope that's how you pronounce it, which was in then communist Yugoslavia, now Slovakia. Yugoslavia was more open to the West than other countries in the Eastern Bloc, and Žižek was an avid reader of Western theorists. His main interests lay with Hegel and Lacan, but he also wrote and spoke on Kant, Heidegger, Althusser, Derrida, Kristeva, Levi-Strauss, and Deleuze. And Žižek's big break came in 1989 with the publication of The Sublime Object of Ideology, which catapulted him to fame in the English-speaking academy. And since then, he's published over 60 books, as well as, you know, hundreds of think pieces and journal articles in publications around the world. He also maintains a relentless schedule of speaking engagements, lecturing to big crowds on an almost weekly basis. So it's kind of like his intellectual output is kind of as frenetic as his speaking style would suggest. So what kind of theorist is Žižek? I think to situate him straightforwardly in the Marxist tradition is a bit of a stretch. By his own account, he's more of a Hegelian, and that's with Hegel refracted through the lens of Lacanian psychoanalysis. As Žižek himself puts it, his work is composed of three centres of gravity: Hegelian dialectics, Lacanian psychoanalytic theory, and contemporary criticism of ideology. And still Žižek, The three circles are not, however, of the same weight. It's their middle term, the theory of Jacques Lacan, which is, as Marx would say, the general illumination which bathes all the other colours and modifies their particularity. Okay, so I think this is... When I was writing this talk, I was like, how the hell am I going to navigate through Zizek? Because there's so much there. I think this is a good way to break it down. First, a little on what Zizek took from Hegel, then a bit on the what he calls the, you know, quoting Marx, the general illumination of Lacanian psychoanalysis, and then how he brings these together in his particular brand of ideological criticism. Okay, on Hegel, I mean, Zizek's written like entire 1,000-page books on Hegel, so if you're a Hegel scholar, this is going to be very kind of perfunctory. And maybe if you're a Hegel scholar, you should go and read that 1,000-page book on Hegel. But I'm just going to give a brief overview. So the main aspects of Hegelianism that Zizek draws on are the ideas of totality, contradiction, and the radical negativity at the core of the human subject. So Hegel's notion of totality amounts, in essence, to the idea that truth is whole. We can't understand anything, objects, events, experiences, and so on, in isolation. Every phenomenon is formed and defined through the network of relations that connect it to everything else. And Zizek's Hegelianism is evident in the connections he makes between aspects of contemporary society that other writers would see as completely kind of autonomous and separate. One example would be how, far from being a clash of civilizations, the conflict between neoliberal capitalism and Islamic fundamentalism is actually a conflict produced and sustained by the dynamics of the overarching totality of capitalist globalization. As Zizek himself puts it, fundamentalism and terrorism are the phenomena in which the West gets its own truth back from the non-capitalist world in an inverted, violent form. So this brings us to another of Hegel's ideas that Zizek draws on, which is the idea that the totality is riven with contradictions, which are ultimately kind of what drives things forward. So truth for Hegel is not some kind of static, eternal essence. Rather, truth is a process. Truth is historical. From this perspective, views that seem completely opposed can actually both be part of truth in the broadest sense. The truth of capitalism, for example, can't be captured by any fact or figure. Its truth lies, rather, in the unfolding of the class conflict at the heart of the system. Okay, so the final key Hegelian notion that Zizek draws on is the idea of the radical negativity at the core of the human subject. And this is basically the fact that as human beings, we're not just absorbed in our environment in an immediate sense. In perceiving what's around us, we're aware of ourselves as a perceiver. And this opens up the potential for us to step back and question what we're seeing. It also means we're not completely subject to the immediacy of our desires and drives. Our negativity, for Zizek, is the ultimate ground of our freedom. Instead of just falling headlong into action, we stop and consider questions like, you know, is this the right thing to do, and so on. And so for Zizek, this is the key to the potential for human emancipation. It's the nothing at the heart of subjectivity that allows for us to step back and reject the political reality of which we're part and to potentially found something radically new. Okay, so I imagine some of this Hegelian stuff is pretty familiar to Marxists, because, you know, obviously Marx drew a lot on Hegel. Zizek's Lacanianism, however, is another matter entirely. At first glance, it really seems like an odd fit. It's kind of like, you know, you think about psychoanalysis is like, you know, what a patient happens with a patient on the couch and their analysts, you know, talking through their issues and, you know, hopefully, you know, coming to some resolution. You know, what's this got to do with, like, politics, never mind the project of overthrowing capitalism? But Zizek belongs to the tradition of what are called, like, Freudo-Marxists, which also included people like Marcuse and Eric Fromm. And particularly important for these theorists was the question of why the Western working class, you know, in Western Europe and so on, hadn't played the revolutionary role that was ascribed to them by Marx. And the answer for Zizek lies in the unconscious attachments we have to the existing order. And it's through the work of Lacan that he thinks we can understand this. The better to unshackle ourselves from the system and open the space for something new. It's in this vein that Zizek claims that Lacanian theory is perhaps the most radical contemporary version of the Enlightenment. Okay. So among the most important ideas that Zizek takes from Lacan is the idea of enjoyment, which in French is jouissance. And you have to say jouissance. It's a bit fancy. You can't just say enjoyment. Jouissance. The other thing is it's not enjoyment. It's not just, you know, going out with your friends for a drink or like going to the movies or something like that. Enjoyment is akin to the Freudian notion for Zizek, jouissance, is akin to the Freudian notion of the death drive. So this is basically the opposite of the drive to flourish and succeed. It's the instinct for self-destruction. So, you know, pushing aside any question of like morality, you know, ethics, and just kind of like going on a tear, you know, self-destructive tear. Jouissance is in one sense about pleasure seeking, but it's not the kind of pleasure that we'd actively seek or consciously seek. Rather, it's the secret ways in which we get off on things that are regarded as pathological or self-destructive and which are inevitably disavowed as something suffered against our will. Okay, and we'll come back to jouissance in a bit. So another aspect of Lacan's work that Zizek draws on is his understanding of how the individual subject is integrated into the social order through the unconscious identification with the big other, in capital letters, which is basically the network of sociocultural rules that, codified in language, constitute the field in which we must situate ourselves if we're to interact meaningfully with society. So the subject for Zizek, following Lacan, is profoundly decentered. We may think we know who we are and who we'd like to be. We have an ideal ego, which is the ideal self that on a conscious level we kind of judge ourselves against. In the Lacanian framework, we also have an ego ideal, and that's capitalized as well, so you know that's special, which builds on the Freudian notion of the superego, and which involves an unconscious attachment to the big other and to the master signifiers that structure the symbolic order of the social world. So later on I'll kind of illustrate this more. But an example of such a master signifier within the symbolic order of capitalism would be the idea of the nation. On a conscious level, we might think we define ourselves without any reference to this at all. But on a deeper unconscious level, most people would understand their status as, you know, an Australian or some other nationality to kind of be a constituent part of their identity. And master signifiers are basically like the ideological keywords that sit together the symbolic framework of social life into a coherent whole. And it's within and against this framework that on the most basic level we have to find our identity. Like, we can't, like, to not situate yourself within that framework is just to be mad, basically. To have no identity. All right. Okay, so now we can come to Zizek's particular brand of ideological critique. And I think this is where it gets more interesting and possibly more accessible, if anyone's having difficulty following that more dense stuff. Okay, so for Marxist ideology is basically the ruling ideas, the belief systems that, through the dominant institutions of capitalism, like the education system, the media, and so on, are drummed into the heads of workers and everyone else in society, and which function to naturalize the system and head off challenges to it. It's the common sense ideas that buttress the status quo and which bear no resemblance to the real situation in which workers find themselves and the actual ways in which they can improve their lives. So Zizek's take on this theory is almost unrecognizable from the classical Marxist version. As British Marxist Terry Eagleton puts it, Zizek sees ideological power as resting finally on the libidinal rather than the conceptual, on the way we hug our chains rather than the way we entertain beliefs. Or as Zizek himself puts it, the fundamental level of ideology is not that of an illusion masking the real state of things, but that of an unconscious fantasy structuring our social reality itself. And it's here that the idea of enjoyment, or jouissance, really comes into its own. In the classical Marxist version, ideology, you know, and there's complications to this which I'll touch on later, But broadly speaking, ideology is something that's imposed on workers from outside. And to be freed from it, we only need to be won away on the level of ideas to, you know, the truth of revolutionary class consciousness, or however you want to put it. And the way this happens, as Marx saw it, is through struggle. So it's through engaging in struggle that workers overcome things like, you know, racism and sexism and get a sense of their collective power. For Zizek, though, it's not so simple. The reality of contemporary capitalism is that while exploitation is rampant and there are many, many reasons to oppose it, the vast majority of workers go about their daily lives in complete accordance with the established rituals and ideological strictures of the system. And the explanation for this lies, as Zizek sees it, in the secret enjoyment that people get from the ideological attachments that bind them to the system. Enjoyment in the sense of jouissance. Okay. This doesn't mean necessarily that people consciously identify with the dominant ideologies. In fact, one of the, I think, best things about Zizek's theory is it can help us to understand the kind of widespread disengagement and cynicism that is typical of politics in the world today. In capitalism today, despite the propaganda barrage to which we're subject by the education system, the media and so on, there's widespread disillusionment with the ruling ideologies. Yet even where people don't believe in the ruling ideology, they still behave for the most part as if they do. Despite their misgivings, people tend to play by the rules. They go to work, they try to get ahead, and they try to succeed in the roles that have been apportioned to them within the system. In this context, it becomes much more difficult to convince people of a revolutionary worldview. As Zizek himself put it, it's as if in late capitalism, words do not count, no longer oblige. They increasingly lose their performative power. Whatever someone says is drowned in general indifference. The emperor is naked and the media trumpet forth the fact, yet no one really seems to mind. That is, people continue to act as if the emperor was not naked. And, you know, anyone who's a socialist trying to spread the ideas of socialism on a campus or anywhere else could probably identify a bit with that kind of thing. So Zizek's explanation for this relies on the notion of jouissance as an unconscious and illicit enjoyment of the very ideological bonds which may be consciously rejected. This enjoyment is not about consciously, you know, saying like, I love capitalism, I love democracy, you know, capitalist democracy and so on. It's more about the unconscious performance of the institutional rituals that go with the system. As Zizek puts it, the illusion is not on the side of knowledge. It's already on the side of reality itself, of what people are doing. So the practice of engaging with these institutional rituals, such as voting in elections, functions to create a level of unconscious identification with the system that can't be shaken purely through rational argument. In Zizek's terms, this is the level of ideological fantasy. And it's here that we come back to the Lacanian account of identity formation through attachment to the big other, the big other of the symbolic order, and the master signifiers which kind of stitch that all together. Zizek draws on this account to show how capitalist ideology really like penetrates like right to the core of our identity and our being. So take once again nationalism. So this is a classic case of, for Zizek, of a kind of sublime object of ideology, which is is something very important for identity formation, except it's also like completely nebulous. Like when I was doing this talk, I was seriously having a think about what is Australia? Like what's the Australian national interest? It's like, there's nothing. Maybe in the discussion someone can tell me. It's completely nebulous. Nevertheless, we identify, you know, people identify as Australians. However, on a conscious level, it sort of doesn't matter whether or not we identify with the idea of the Australian nation or think the national interest is something we should be very concerned about. On an unconscious level, we could, or might, according to Zizek's account, define ourselves, at least in part, with regards to our status as an Australian, and gain an illicit pleasure from our enactment of institutional rituals of nationhood. And I had a recent experience of this, which I think is quite revealing. Obviously, I wasn't enacting nationhood as other people who I was observing. Okay. The example is the way that people just automatically stand up for the national anthem at football games. So a couple of months ago, I was at Princess Park in Carlton, inner city Melbourne suburb, for an AFL women's game. And it was like full of kind of inner city lefty types, you know, that you expect to go to something like that. And many of them, it was like a couple of weeks after the Invasion Day rally, and probably like a lot of them had gone to the Invasion Day rally. Yeah, when we were asked to stand for the singing of the anthem, everyone just did what they were told. So everyone just got up. Not me and my friends. We had a protest. Now, you could, of course, just put this down to people not wanting to make a scene or whatever, but for Žižek, there's something more profound going on. As Žižek sees it, many people who consider themselves radical or even anti-capitalist are on a deeper level profoundly attached to the status quo. So we may talk the talk, you know, go to a rally, chant about Aboriginal land, and so on. And yet the very next week, stand respectfully for the playing of the ridiculous ode to genocide that is the Australian National Anthem. Okay. Now, another aspect of Žižek's understanding of modern capitalist society that's worth mentioning is how, in contrast to previous social orders, and even to earlier periods of capitalist development, there's this imperative for everyone to be enjoying themselves all the time. And now I'm talking not about jouissance or illicit enjoyment, but just kind of like the kind of thing people do in coke ads and so on. Yeah, I didn't know much about that. Žižek thinks this provides another stability mechanism for the system. Basically, it's impossible really to rebel anymore. We're encouraged to think that by wearing particular kinds of clothes, going to particular kinds of clubs, having particular kinds of sex, and so on, we're enacting our freedom to, you know, define ourselves however we please. In the past, this stuff could really count as rebellion, but today it's really just all part of the capitalist game. Think, for example, of the way in which LGBTIQ identities have been appropriated and defined in terms of consumption. And for Žižek, the various forms of identity politics that are widespread on the left would fall into this category. The capitalist imperative to enjoy and to, you know, be yourself doesn't know any boundaries of ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, and so on. And taken together, this stuff helps explain for Žižek the resilience of capitalism. Okay. I want to talk briefly now about how Žižek's understanding of human subjectivity and how our unconscious drives and attachments bind us to the social order of capitalism is reflected in his politics. First, I think it's important to have a note of caution with Žižek. Not only is Žižek a theoretical bowerbird, he's a political peacock. There's a big element of showmanship which is part of why he's gained such a big audience and part of why there's meme pages on the internet with, like, you know, 100,000 likes sharing memes with stuff Žižek said. But you've got to kind of separate this stuff out from the kind of more substantial and lasting political commitments he articulates in his work. So in the broader sense, Žižek sees him as building on the Enlightenment tradition of trying to apply rational thought to help build a better, freer society. He sees capitalism as a completely irrational system that behind the facade of kind of individual freedom and democracy conceals the core of the most materially and spiritually degrading despotism. In capitalism, as Žižek sees it, no one can be truly free. We're all enslaved to the real, capital R real, of commodity production, the underlying moving force of society to which we're bound right down to the unconscious core of our individual identities and decisions. So the starting point for Žižek's politics is a desire to liberate humanity from its enslavement to capital. And so in this, I think, he's basically like Marx. It's, you know, so far, so Marx. This Marxist. For Žižek's understanding of human subjectivity, with its dark underbelly of unconscious and destructive drives and desires, pushes him in quite a different direction to the one taken by Marx. The idea of communism for Marx is a system that allows for the full flourishing of the human personality. The alienation we experience under capitalism, our disconnection from others and from our own essence as creative labouring beings, can be fully resolved, he thinks, in a system of collective and democratic control over production. For Zizek, in contrast, the internal strife inherent to subjectivity and identity formation isn't something that we can rid ourselves of. Whether in communism or any other political system, we'll never stop gaining illicit enjoyment from things that are basically destructive. The thing to do, he says, is to recognise the terrifying dimension of human subjectivity and to try to articulate a modus vivendi with it. Communism is, for Zizek, certainly a big step up from capitalism, but it's far from a recipe for universal happiness and absolute social cohesion. Okay. Zizek's psychoanalytic approach to politics also has consequences for the means by which he thinks that we can build a better society. His model, I think, is ultimately that of the psychoanalytic cure, of the patient talking through their issues with an analyst and ultimately reconstructing their unconscious ideological fantasy into a less destructive form. In his early work, actually, from the late 80s or the 80s to the mid-90s, Zizek actually remained within the liberal framework. The idea was to work within the existing structures of democracy to progressively limit the destructive tendencies of capitalism and expand the possibilities for individual autonomy. And in 1990, he actually ran as presidential candidate for the Liberal Democracy of Slovenia, which is a centre-left party which actually went on to dominate Slovenian politics for the rest of the decade. And he didn't win, which is probably better for everyone. There's a definite turn, though, in Zizek's political approach in the late 1990s. And this coincides with the period of his interest in German idealist philosopher Friedrich Schelling. The aspect of Schelling that particularly appealed to Zizek was his account of the creation of the universe by God. And as after this, Zizek gets more kind of into theology and, you know, quite obscure kind of idealist sort of philosophies coming from Schelling. From this, Zizek drew a much more decisionistic approach to the question of the possible founding of a new political community. In his work from the early 2000s to today, the emphasis is no longer on working within the system, but in mobilising the destructiveness at the heart of the human psyche to break violently with the existing social and political order. And the height of progressive, decisionistic divine violence, as Zizek sees it, is the Red Terror of the Russian Civil War. Zizek sees this kind of supposedly boundless violence as drawing on our unconscious drives. He says, divine violence is an expression of pure drive, of the undeadness, the excess of life, which strikes at bare life regulated by law. And this kind of violence is necessary, as Zizek sees it, in order to break people away from the deeply entrenched ideological fantasies that bind them to the current system. Again and again, he comes back to Lenin as the figure that he regards as most embodying this spirit of decisionistic violence. Apart from the violence of the Red Terror, he also refers to Lenin's role in 1917, to his willingness to cast aside all previously established traditions, including those of the Bolshevik Party themselves, and to strike out boldly on the path to revolution. And you can kind of get a sense of what he's talking about from the famous account of the Menshevik historian Sukarnov of Lenin's first speech to his party comrades on his arrival back in Petrograd in 1917, which is basically when Lenin had a position that was totally different to any of the other leaders of the Bolshevik Party. And Sukarnov writes about this meeting, "It seemed as though all the elements had risen from their abodes, and the spirit of universal destruction, knowing neither barrier nor doubts, neither human difficulties nor human calculations, was hovering around Chesinkaya's reception room above the heads of the bewitched disciples." Okay. I imagine there's a few people here who are cringing a bit at Zizek's description of Lenin as the ideal revolutionary. Not because Lenin isn't actually a great revolutionary, but because Zizek's version of him is completely distorted, and it derives, I think, from Zizek's understanding of politics as based on a psychoanalytic cure. And it's on this level, and not on the level of, you know, the individual political points he makes about refugees and Me Too and so on, that I think our greatest source of discomfort with Zizek's politics should lie. To the extent there's anything really worth our time in Zizek, his work on ideology would be top of the list. I think there's actually a genuine and novel contribution there to understanding the resilience of capitalist ideology, which builds on the tradition of Marxist ideological criticism. Certainly, in a time of such widespread apathy and cynicism as today, his account of how surface-level opposition to the system can coincide with a deep unconscious commitment to the ideological myths that buttress it seems to touch on something essential about the political situation we're in. I'd say, though, that this is actually nothing particularly new to the Marxist tradition. Zizek is more or less unique in applying a Lacanian psychoanalytic framework to the problem of ideology, but he's far from the first to identify that the ruling ideas of our society aren't simply maintained by a top-down imposition from the education system, the media, and so on. One example would be the Hungarian Marxist George Lukács and his work on class consciousness and reification. Lukács extends Marx's analysis of commodity fetishism to help understand how capitalist ideology is inscribed into the very conditions of existence of the working class. Another thinker, I think, who has written about these issues is the Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci, who wrote extensively on the idea of contradictory consciousness and how the bourgeoisie constructs and maintains its ideological hegemony through the everyday institutions and practices of life under capitalism. And for both Lukács and Gramsci, their critique of ideology is actually part of a broader argument for revolutionary organisation. So with the case that class struggle alone could break the ideological chains that bind workers to the system, there'd be no need for this. But the reality is that in the absence of a revolutionary organisation to generalise from individual struggles to be the memory of the class and so on, the working class can't achieve the level of class consciousness required to overthrow the system. Zizek's critique of ideology, I really actually think, points in the same direction. However, instead of coming to grips with the relationship between political leadership, working class organisation, and spontaneity in the revolutionary process, he focuses only on the leadership aspect. So for Zizek, the Russian Revolution is all about Lenin. Lenin is the great leader whose ability to traverse the ideological fantasy of Russian society allows him to break entirely with the symbolic order and found a new society, a totally new society, through ruthless political and material violence. And Zizek wrote an article last year on the 100-year anniversary of the October Revolution, where he said that the key to the success of the revolution lay in Lenin's ruthless will to grab power and then to hold it. So suffice to say, I don't think there's much room here for the kind of mass, collective, working-class action that I would see as kind of driving the revolutionary process in Russia. Rather, the workers become just a kind of passive mass onto which is projected Lenin's vision of a new social order. And Zizek's actually quite explicit on this point. In the same article I just quoted, he claims that, quote, "the failure of the working class as the revolutionary subject is at the very core of the Bolshevik Revolution, and that Lenin's art was to detect the rage potential of the disappointed peasants." Okay, so suffice to say that I think Zizek is wrong in seeing Lenin as the epitome of his very elitist and authoritarian view of revolutionary politics. Lenin was a great revolutionary leader, but he could only lead on the basis of his painstaking work in building up the ranks of the Bolshevik Party, a party that by 1917 had deep roots in the most militant sections of the Russian working class. Without the involvement of masses of workers in making their own history and a party to organise them, Lenin would have remained the obscure and isolated figure he was in the years leading up to 1917. And I think, as a Hegelian thinker, I think it's actually surprising that Zizek kind of only falls on kind of one side of this dialectical equation. Okay. So to wrap up, although I said we shouldn't dismiss Zizek purely on the basis of the reasonably consistent stream of objectionable things he's been saying lately, I do think these reflect deeper issues with his philosophy and his politics. So take the question of refugees. his overall position, it's not quite as bad as some of the stuff I said at the start might suggest. He's not against refugees. He says it's neoliberal capitalism that's to blame, you know, the wars fought in the name of spreading freedom and democracy and so on, and that a real solution will only come with the abolition of these conditions on a global scale. The problem is that his understanding of how we can get there is thoroughly elitist and authoritarian. What we need, as Zizek sees it, is to apply order and rationality to this messy situation, to regulate the flow of refugees into Europe, and to ensure that they're able to integrate into mainstream society. At the end of one of his articles, he states that, "When I was young, such an organised attempt to regulate the commons was called communism. Maybe we should reinvent it. Maybe this, in the long term, is our only solution." Now, that might sound quite shocking and radical, and I think that's basically the intended effect. But there's actually a sleight of hand going on here, and I think it's one that's like very significant for people who regard themselves as revolutionaries. In calling for communism as a solution to the refugee crisis, and identifying this with rational control and regulation from the top, Zizek has erased the working class as playing any active role in shaping its own future. For him, solutions, however radical, come from the top down. And when you combine this with his penchant for divine violence, I feel like it's kind of a worrying mix. Now, in contrast to this is the revolutionary Marxist tradition, tradition to which Lenin and the Bolsheviks actually belonged, and a tradition in which the active role of workers in the revolutionary process is central to establishing the kind of collective democracy that we identify with socialism. In the case of refugees, I think a much more genuinely Leninist approach would be to see the situation in terms of the potential for common struggle between the people who are fleeing persecution in places like Syria and the people who in the West are fighting against, you know, neoliberal capitalism and their exploitation. So in the end, I think those of you who came here thinking that you should reject Zizek on the basis of his stand on refugees or other contemporary issues, you're right. What I hope to have shown is that these views aren't just accidental, but arise from his theoretical understanding of capitalism and how it can be changed. So if you're looking for an entertaining, kind of mostly left-wing read about cinema or sex or other topics like that, I think Zizek is definitely worth a look. He's very enjoyable to read on a bunch of stuff. But if you're looking for someone whose theories can help explain capitalism today and like how we can actually change capitalism, you know, and fight for something better, then I think there's probably like a list of 50 different people I could give you to read before you get to Zizek. And I'll leave it there.